You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello there, children of all ages. This is Stuart Goldsmith, and you're listening to the Christmas special edition of the Comedian's Comedian podcast, in which we will be talking to Santa Claus himself, a.k.a. Father Christmas, a.k.a. the current wearer of the Father Christmas mantle in one particular place, in one particular time, Mr. Herbie Treehead. Many of you will not be aware of Herbie's work. He is a phenomenal street clown. He was one of my mentors and remains one of my mentors, but certainly in the early days of street performing in the 90s and noughties, Herbie was someone who really exemplified the enormous passion and chaos and theatricality and comedy that I was so drawn to in street performing, that I remain drawn to in so many different aspects of comedy and stand-up, all the types of performing that I love, the stuff that really reaches out and grabs you by the heart. Herbie is very well versed in that. He's an inspiration, a huge influence. He's one of those street performers that all the newer guys get sent to see. And you can take my word for it, Herbie is someone who very much deserves his place here, despite not being a stand-up. I recognise that this is a curveball episode, but I hope you stay with it because there is a tremendous amount to discover and to enjoy in some elements of Herbie's life story and in his whole approach to the craft of comedy in a very different way to most guests on this show. But before we get into that, we are going to really get into the nitty-gritty of what it means to be Santa. When you're Santering, are you Santa or are you Father Christmas, or does it change per kid?
I'm never Father Christmas. I'm always Santa.
Why is that?
Because I grew up with Santa. I think, like, as a kid, I never went to see Father Christmas. You went to see Santa. I think okay. It's a bit of a northeast thing.
Okay.
Like, my Mrs. Joy, she went to see Father Christmas. So I think it's
maybe...
Because
she's a Brummie.
Yeah, it's a regional thing, maybe.
Okay.
But it's really distinct. I'm Santa. I don't like being called Father Christmas. and I'm living this at the minute.
Well, this is it. Tell me, this is your first year being Santa. So tell us, this conversation originated for the listener. Herbie is a dear friend of mine for 20 years, friend, mentor, inspiration, fabulous street clown, street performer, and successful failure. And we had a conversation the other morning, last Thursday morning, and I thought we have to have this or a version of it on the podcast because I was in a bad mood about something or other. And I rang you and I said, what are you up to? And you told me what you're up to. So let's just go straight back to that conversation and let's just reprise. You're a performer of all sorts of things and have been your whole life, as far as I know. We'll get into your life later on. Tell us about what it means to you to be Santa.
It's something... Santa, I wanted to try Santa, and normally I'm touring at Christmas with Slightly Fat Features, which is a group that I'm in, a comedy-style group, and we weren't touring, so I thought, right, let's go and have a go at Santa. So I scouted around and I talked to a few people, and I wanted something, because I haven't been well, that I could sit down and do. And I got this contract at a shopping centre, and I turned up for the gig. And I was a bit apprehensive. I'm going, I'm 51 years old. Is this what it's become? I'm taking a gig because I want to do something. I need some money. And then I went in and I put the stuff on. And I just went, right, I'm going to go for this. It's going to be real. So I go to the shopping centre and I have the brief day where I become Santa. And I think, okay, what am I going to do? Is this going to kill me or is it going to be... Well, we'll see. So the first day I start, the elf, chief elf, she's very experienced and she knows how to work through stuff. She'd be a great production manager,
okay,
stage manager. She goes, you're going to get a line. You're going to have to knock them through in between a minute and a half to 3 minutes.
Okay.
And they've got to feel like they've just had the biggest experience of their lives. So I started doing this and I'm trying to do almost like a 3 minute routine.
Yeah.
Really trying to, and I'm looking at who's coming in. And so if it's a family, I'm trying to work and I'm trying to get them to laugh because I'm looking for the laughs as well. And I'm trying to be Santa and I'm trying to, and I'm trying all these things to go, oh. And then after about maybe an hour or two, this girl comes in. And she leans forward and she looks maybe about 6 inches from my eyes. And I think, oh, this is going to be awkward. This is like, she's not believing this. And she just starts engaging on this level of unbelievableness. And I'm like, whoa, this is good.
What do you mean, engaging on a level of unbelievableness? What does that mean?
That she believes. And it's prior to a brief conversation that you and I had a few days ago, which you said, and you summed it up. She doesn't believe that I'm not playing Santa. I'm Santa.
Yeah.
I'm Santa in that moment.
And for me, there is a mythic quality to Santa whereby Santa is an idea and an ideal it is a thing that you can become by putting on the suit. It is a genuinely magic thing. If you do it, you have to honour it if you do it properly, and you become the thing that people have always pretended to be throughout the years. It's like, it's probably got something in common with being a court jester, or it's, do you know what I mean? It's in its sacredness. You become the thing. Have I explained that any better? I think you probably did it better.
Weirdly, it connects in with being a street clown. And I don't kind of talk about the clown like performing and teaching clown and all of that, because my clown was born of the street. But there is something, when you're in it, you become it just for that time. And then you go back to everything else in your life. And with the Santa it is, I'll give you some examples of it. I'm sitting there and there's some space in between and it becomes uncomfortable. It's hard work. And then it was the end of the day. And one of the elves comes in and goes, right, they tell me who's coming through. So I'm prepared, a little 10-second preparation. And they go, okay, there's this guy is coming through. He's in his 30s and he's a believer. And he's with his sister, who's his carer. So when he comes through, I don't want to use his name because I don't feel I've got the right to out in the public sphere.
Mm-hmm.
He comes through and I go, oh, welcome, Merry Christmas. And he comes in and he looks at me and he's a fully grown man the size of us.
Yeah.
And he looks at me and just goes, Santa, you remember me.
Oh, and because you said his name. You won't say his name here, but yeah, okay.
And I go, how could I ever forget you? And he sits down and I go, have you got a letter? Have you got your letter? And he goes, and he brings out a letter and it's sealed and he opens it up and he takes it out and he starts reading me this letter. And there is his sister. And his sister's in her 40s. And she's also got a young kid of about 12 who's in a wheelchair and another boy of about 12 with her. And she said, oh, I'm the other child's carer for the day as well. And I do this thing because I don't say, have you been naughty? Have you been nice and all of that? I can't be bothered with that. I just want to get something a bit more out of it. And with him, I have to give a present at the end. So we go through all the thing and he's connected. And I go to give him the present. And there's a thing I've kind of adopted to say, I go, look, can I give you this present? It's a pre-Christmas Christmas present. And he goes, yes. I say, can you do me a favour? Can you look after your sister for me? And he goes, yes. And I just turn to her and she's crying. And I'm Santa and I'm not allowed to cry. Mm. And I want to cry so much. And the point about that, and then I do Santa high five with him and I do it with the other boy. And he high fives me. And she says, he doesn't do that. And this is not about me, the person. It's about the entity of the situation that we're in. And then she goes, he never does that. And she said, can I take a photo of him doing it? And he did it again. And then they walk out. And that's 3 minutes of time. And I tell him to look after his family and look after the world and just be happy and look after yourself, I always say. And it sounds a bit wanky, but it's not, because I'm allowed to do that because I'm Santa.
It's I love it, man. It's like, and I'm kind of getting misty-eyed listening to this, partly because it's just like the idea of Santa is like a game passed down through the ages of, and it, the game, you know, the word, the jeu, whatever it is, it's a thing of kindness. It's like kindness is the trick. Like, is it the only reason to be Santa, the only reason for someone to put on the costume and be Santa is to be kind? Do you mean, obviously there's a commercial aspect to it, you're in a shopping centre, but you in particular, I think, can look past that and recognise this is a real thing, and you just always become this spirit of kindness that is like, God, it's one of the best things ever. Isn't it just like I don't think of myself as a very Christmassy person particularly. I like the idea of just time with your family and all the rest of it. But just hearing you talk about it now just makes me feel like, oh yeah, it's not about presents and all the rest of it. I don't want to start sort of waxing lyrical about the joys of Christmas, but it's like an example of a kind of theatrical or performative sort of apex where it becomes something real.
You know, it's the last thing. It's one of the last things. And this is why it's like street shows and live comedy and live performing, especially live stuff outside. It's a place where you go, where it doesn't work on a screen the same. It's a presence. And you walk in there and they stand there. He's another example. There's two more examples. A young kid comes in and he's looking at me. And I'm watching him. And he's about 7 or 8. That's that turning age. And I've grown a beard that I've got now, but it was on the way. But I had another beard over the top. And he grabbed the beard off. And then he's seen another beard underneath. And I just said, I'm incognito. And he didn't know what that meant. And I didn't know what it meant. and it was great. But there was a couple in their 20s. And they had a 3-year-old boy and she was pregnant, ready to drop another child next week. Now, 20-year-old guys, I've got 3 boys who are 20, 18 and 16. I'm used to seeing these big, massive looking kids that kind of inhabit. Because 3 20-year-olds come into a space when you're 50 and you feel like there's 300 people in there.
Okay.
And he comes in and he's got a high top head. You know, that's that the hairstyle from the 80s that's come back now. I'm short around the sides and the back. And he comes in and I'm watching him and he's swaggering in with his little boy. And I'm watching him. And guys always stand in the corner and let mothers take care of the business and the likes of. And that sort of happens. And they were ready to do a family photo. And I said, you know, I organised the kids, the mother. Oh, they had a 2-year-old as well. The mother had the other child there. And I said, Dad, come round here and sit here beside me. And he sat on the chair beside me on the arm. And he threw his arms around me. He's like 6'1". He threw his arms around me and just grabbed a hold. And I said, are you missing Santa? And he went, yes. And I'm like, these moments happen all the time. They take the photo, he gets himself back around, and then he stands back in the corner and becomes the kind of background furniture and allows me to do the thing. And it might have been the only time, I don't know. I got three kids and we got a family photo for the first time 2 years ago.
Really?
Because it's not that you don't want to, the time doesn't happen.
Yeah, right.
There was another family came in and the security came and said, you've got to be aware of this family. And I'm like, obviously known to them.
Okay.
And the family walk in and two young daughters and the mother all dressed elegantly. And the guy is a massive monster of a man in jeans and a T-shirt. And he comes in and they all come in. And everybody's cautious up to that point. I've been briefed. And I start working it. And working it, I'm watching him.
What do you mean by working it?
I start working the routine through. It's just, okay. Honestly, it's so close to... I've got a routine that I do in Slightly Fat Features, which is the cup, stick, ball. It's a magic... It's a take on cups and balls routine, and it's supposed to be a minute, and normally it's about four.
Yeah.
But it's like banging it in, you know, banging it through, finding the gaps, finding the temperament, and delivering that, and then... You get into the same routine with this. So I'm like, right, I'm making me options. And this is why it's so the same as working a crowd. Because you go, who am I going to work first? Right, I'm going to work those more engaged. I'm going to flip the eye over and just connect with the person that's not engaged. Then I'm going to swap over from the engaged person who I've got fully committed. I'm going to look over to which is the dad.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to throw a line at him. I'm going to throw him something that he can respond to, but it's never going to be an attack. It's always going to be inclusion, but it's going to be, I'm going to try and pitch it at a level that he's allowed to get. Playing it like that. So these two young girls are there. They're like 6 years old and 3 years old. And I'm going through the thing of, you know, asking them, have they written a letter? Have they, you know, what, you know, have you got your tree up yet? Because they make some reindeer food.
Okay.
And I tell them, put the reindeer food under the tree. And on Christmas Eve, when you go to sleep, your house will be quiet. And mum and dad, they'll be in the jammies and they'll be asleep because they'll be knackered. And me saying that, and then I always glance to the dad or the mum. And I get a reaction from them because they go, oh, he gets this. And then bring it down and say, leave the reindeer food. And I'll come with me sleigh. And me reindeers, and I'll bring you some presents. But have you got any carrots in your house? And they look bewildered. Have you got any carrots? And the kids always say no, and the parents are going, you know, I've had a family have a fight about carrots now. And the parents are going, of course we've got carrots. And this little boy is going, we haven't got carrots, we don't like carrots, right? All of that. And I explain about Rudolph. Leave it for Rudolph. Leave a carrot for Rudolph and a pie for me and maybe a drink, maybe some water or some milk. And then I go, oh, maybe something stronger. And I look back to Dad again.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get a reaction from Dad. I'm in. So I do all this and I play this and the kids are great. They get up, do it. That's just the kids did the photo. They go out and as Dad's walking out, Dads are always the last one to walk out this. It's a tiny space. It's 8 foot by 8 foot. So, and the dad's walking out. And as he walks out, he walks past the curtain and then takes a step backwards and he goes, thanks, mate. And I went, no, no, no. Thanks, Santa. And he goes, really sheepishly, thanks, Santa. And walks away. And I'm like, that's the power of this. It's not the power of me. It's the power of... this myth, like you say, it's the history. We've all had it. We've all grown with it. And it was going to be a bit of a shitty gig. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. And it's become, I've learned so much about performing again after being a performer for 30 odd years. And that's what's incredible. and I've got more to do.
And so describe what the job is, because what did you say to me? It's 100, you get 100 sittings and they're about 3 minutes long each. Is that right? Or what kind of hours are we talking? Let's just talk brass tacks about what the day looks like.
I'll start it on a Saturday. I'll start at 11. I'll work through to 1:30. I'll have a half an hour break. And then I'll start at 2 and I'll run till 6. And do about 70, but that will peak at 150 in the days up to Christmas. And then on a Sunday, it's 12 till 5. And then in the final days of Christmas, there's 5 days and it's full on from 11 till 6 every day. And they come through. So and this is what's incredible, the mechanisms of it is if the queue's coming through fast, I have to deliver without it seeming to be kind of rushed.
Perfunctory.
You know this. You know when you go, because I'm no good at getting up and doing a 5 minute. I need 10, that's why I'm a street performer. Yeah. I need 40 minutes just to get started, to play. And when you go and do something that's 3 minutes, your job is to make it feel like everybody's been there for an hour without it being long and not a minute. And then we got down to a minute and a half. So head elf comes in and goes, minute and a half now. And I go, okay, right. And I'm thinking through, right, what am I going to cut here? What am I going to bring in? And it's becoming a script, a fluid script that I can pull stuff out and pull stuff in and add in. And, you know, and I try and add something new every day. So I'm doing, last week I did about, I just went, just as they're going out the door, I go, don't forget, look out your window. Just before you go to sleep, look out your window and look at the sky. It might take 10 minutes. But you'll see me flying across that sky. And you might see Rudolph's red nose just flashing as you're going across.
I feel like you are... I am sure that you are a brilliant Santa, because I know you and I know your passion and I know your commitment. And we can all hear how much you care and genuinely involve yourself with it. I'm sure there are Santas out there who are less brilliant and less engaged. When you brought yourself to it, what were your expectations of the job? Because we've all got an image of, like, I mean, the Santa I think of, one of the first Santas I think of, if you say Santa to me, is Dan Aykroyd in Trading Places. Yeah. It'd be like all of that. Smuggling an entire salmon out under his beard. You know, that horrible kind of grotty Santa kind of thing.
And all of that came to mind. You know, Bad Santa and all of that. It's a movie that the minute I told my kids, they're like, Bad Santa, Dad, you're perfect. You know, because, and you know my street performance especially, you know, I'm, you know, I'll take risk and I'll push it. And that's what, I think that's been a great learning curve for me to be in there and be quite staid. You know, I sit down for the whole thing. I don't get up. I got up once at the early and I got up and I terrified everybody, including the parents, because Santa's sitting there and then Santa stands up and then suddenly there's a different thing happening.
Yeah, that's weird.
So Santa has to sit down. Santa has his status and the strength by sitting there. So it becomes very animated, physically moving forward and moving right forward. I've got glasses on and the likes of, and white gloves. So it's just like all of that element of the true physical person goes away. I went into it thinking, I'm going to do this. As a performer, as my job, I've always been, if I do something, I fully commit to it. And I indulge myself and live it because I love doing that. And that's what I went in. I went, right, I want to get somewhere with this. I want to work out what it is. And I like the entity of Santa. I like the idea that it is something that's omnipresent, that is there and everybody gets it. So, and it's really accessible. And I really like accessible theatre and accessible performing. That's one of the key factors. I've got quite a high social principle in life regarding performing. That's why I'm a street performer. I want accessibility. And what's really interesting about this Santa gig, because they pay to come in, but there's the families outside, stand outside with four kids, And I know them because I've been them, can't afford to bring their kids in. And I lean forward and I wave. And that sometimes is the magical moment of just waving. I've even got that down to, I wave with one hand and look and smile.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go back and then I come forward and I wave again. And then they go there, they start waving. And I wave with two hands and I put my thumbs up. And they put the thumbs up and they run off. And they've had their moment, they've seen Santa. And, you know, that's not... I'm not trying to sound like a socialist hippie. Well, I am, though. Yeah. I'm more an anarchic hippie, but, you know, that's... I hope that helped answer the reason I'm doing it and being part of it.
Was it... Did it feel like it cost you something to... Like, it... Is being Santa a thing that one aspires to, or is it a thing that you think, well... I'm at the age now where I could probably do it. Do you know what I mean? Like, did you, presumably you didn't know it would be this fulfilling going into it.
No, but part of it, I thought, I'm going to work to make it fulfilling. And that's how I've always worked. It's like, if I build something and I've built some really stupid things in my life to perform with physical things, and I'm no engineer, I'll commit fully to it and go through. And I knew that. But, yeah, in the last few years, I've got to this point where I want to do stuff for performance sake. So, you know, with my mates, we got to the pinnacle of where we were trying to go.
Yeah.
With slightly fat features.
Which is, so it's seven... I'm not going to say elderly, but seven guys in tuxes doing a vaudeville.
Yeah, we do.
A series of vaudeville acts.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. It's an absolutely brilliant show. You've toured and you've been to Montreal.
We've did all of that. We've been, you know, we've done all this. And it's run by Gromway Tom, who's just put his life into it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's we've done it 13 years. And, you know, we did Christmas runs at Leicester Square Theatre. We've got pockets around the country where we do sold out places like Lancaster. For some reason in Lancaster, we go there and do a few nights there. They've picked up and we've got all that. We went to Montreal and had to almost build a theatre to make that work, and then got an international comedy award, which was hilarious. And why I'm telling you about that is then we did Sunday night at the Palladium, and we went, all of us, and we did, I think, four routines throughout the night. And when you stand on there, and there's, I think, 2,269 people in front of you in a wall that's had 2,000 years of theatre design to get to that point when they built it.
Mm.
And it feels like you're in a 200-seater. And when we did that, as us as a collective, and we were unknown to everybody, and we made... 2,200 and whatever people laugh because of us a number of times and walked away from that. It's like that becomes your pinnacle. And we've strived to the TV. We've been on TV, you know. We've tried TV. We tried, you know. I mean, we were on Alan Titchmarsh show, and you know. And I made Alan swear live on TV, and he had to apologise, and we've done all of that. And we, like, played that whole game in the industry to try and get to the point where you're going. And then I got to the point, like, 2 years ago of just going, I'm going to do stuff just for the sake of doing it and be lucky enough to make a bit of money or some money or hopefully a lot of money if I can. And that's why I chose Santa. So in the long-winded way, I wanted to do it because I wanted to go, I've done this and I've experienced this. And I think in the back of my mind, I knew it wasn't going to be as bad as the expectation. Because
it's a hard gig.
It's
you
a hard
say
gig.
100 minute and a half long shows or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
That's tough. Just I endurance. Know. That's tough. Focus and concentration and... You know, just having to talk all day. And the weight of expectation as well. Like, your beard can't come off. And if it does come off, you've got to have something to say about it.
Well, that's why I've grown the beard.
Yeah,
I wanted that to be real in the sense that there was a real beard. But the big thing is, It plays on everything that I've learned as a performer. It plays with temperament. It plays with design, with words of physicality. It, all of these things that we strive to get right. And, you know, you get right or you don't get right. And then there's the next one. The good thing about this is, you know, because that thing, if you're only as good as your next show.
Yeah, right.
This is great because you've got one. You've got one in a few minutes. And you can do it, you know, and you shape it. I've walked away from this understanding more about the shape of a routine more than anything. So it's absorbing into me. And it's like going back to school again, even though school was shit and didn't work. It's given me this chance to just, because it's not about it's not about what you're doing. It's not about what you're trying to deliver. It's about what you're doing, is what I'm saying, in the sense of it's teaching me to be disciplined in the structure and push out from different parts of the structure of the routine. And this is so all of that technical aspect, I had a feeling that I would get that out of it. And on the 24th, when I finish, I'm going to be exhausted from that. And then I'm going to Adelaide to start a new venture as in street shows. So, and I wanted some kind of thing that I could really exhaust myself with to get something out of, to take onto that next step and try and make a disaster that I'm going to do maybe a bit better.
I'm wondering how there is so much in your career and in our relationship. Like I described you at the beginning as I considered you a mentor. I felt that when me and Noel went to Edinburgh for the first time with our double act, the Unknown Stuntmen.
What, the other funny guy?
Yeah. You were kind of part of our pedigree. I remember you and Pepe and Vince. And I know that these names won't mean anything to people listening to this, but between the three of you in three wildly different ways, you had this enormous impact on us as teenage street performers. And I remember the sorts of things you would say to me. You would challenge us constantly. You'd go, at the beginning of your show, just challenge yourself to not speak for 10 minutes. You were kind of trying to nudge us. You could see that we had something, and you were trying to nudge us towards being what you considered to be good, because we all know, I think you and I are both really electrified by some of the same elements of street performing, that mythic quality of it, the fact that it has, I for years felt like it had a real sort of nobility to it, because, you know, there were street performers in ancient Egypt 5,000 years ago. You know, it's like it's an infinite thing, and you're a part of it, and as soon as you stand there in the street, put down your ancient Egyptian suitcase and start banging on it and shouting and getting people's attention, you become part of the family tree of street performers. Like that, I think, both really buzzes for both of us. Who were you? What I remember from you when I met you, I mean, was it 20 years ago? Probably longer than that now, maybe 25 years ago. Who were you? I remember you doing your pantomime horse show. Were you doing that one that long ago?
No. No, that's 20 years ago. Before that, I was trying to walk on a rope. I was doing a slack rope.
I remember.
In Covent Garden. And I was so bad at it. So my whole routine was putting the rig together, because that's the clown routine. And so I had two A-frames that I used to tie off to lampposts and stuff like that. And I'd get an audience and I'd have interactive with people, I could do it either talking or not talking. Take about 15, 20 minutes and really engagement, lots of reaction points from the audience, lots of designed reaction points, and enough freedom to have the play, and then I'd get up on the rope and they'd be ready. And then I'd speak to them for a bit, usually, and tell them I'm going to get up on the rope. But by the time I got to that point, they were really unsure whether it was a good idea for me to get on the rope, because I wasn't very good.
You were so clearly inept.
I was so clearly inept. And that wasn't a play. That was because I was so clearly inept, because I've never learned how to do anything properly. And so I could get up on a rope and I could stand on the rope and I could walk out just.
And I have to say, I've always, up until this point, I've always assumed that you were way better at it and that was part of the
game. I'd get out there and I knew I'd have to do it. I did stuff like there's a thing that they used to do hundreds of years ago, once again, walking on ropes. They used to put baskets on your feet. Mm. And so you walk on the baskets with the baskets. Well, I thought it'd be funny to have metal buckets. So I've got two metal buckets and strapped them to my leg. And I'm on the floor and people are going, what's he doing? And I get up and I'd never tried it before. But the bucket slipped and I fell off. I fell off and smashed my leg inside the bucket, but had to get up and get people to hold me. And the thing, especially in Covent Garden, when I used to walk on the rope, I tried a marionette puppet on the rope. I don't know why. I thought it'd be funny to have a marionette puppet because it's ropes, string. Didn't work. So I used to walk out and all the other performers used to come and stand behind. And they all used to be changing money. And they used to, and they're all really world-class jugglers. And I'd try and juggle three juggling clubs and I can't juggle. And normally you've got to juggle about maybe 20 throws to get a decent finale, and they'd all be having a sweepstake. So you get right, it's like 4, 6, 8, and I'd get about 4 or 0, and then they'd be chucking fivers and tenners at each other, big line of them, I can remember, you know. And so I was doing that, but I was playing more. When I first met you, because I met you in Edinburgh, I was kind of just, I was playing, I was doing clowning routines on the floor. And I was doing very well because the idea was you need something big up high to get an audience. And you didn't, because what you could do is you could work the audience and work the audience and get them on your side to the point where the first 200 people were with you, the rest of it's ego. And back to the point, what I liked about Noel and you when we first met is that you were kind of just... You were on the floor. You were doing stuff on the floor, which become a thing. You wore suits as well, because there's a thing about street performers wearing old ill-fitting suits, and there's kind of a difference. There's a particular kind of performer wears a suit. Very, quite English as well in the sense of the history of street performing, where you get kind of, you know, the Australians would wear, you know,
leather
and look and whips and stuff like that. And they'd have a whole style of kind of Mad Maxi almost. Yeah, maybe that's where it comes from. But the English, we kind of wore ill-fitting suits that were always a mess because you'd been out there, you know, and quite dark coloured suits as well, because you can't be on the street with a white suit. It won't last 5 minutes. So I was, you know... I was doing that, and then I did pantomime. And then I had an idea, pantomime horse. I've got, if I get a pantomime horse, it can go in a bag. So I met, I knew a woman who was a costume maker who I'd worked with, and I'd set my lungs on fire, breathing fire, at a venue that I was at, and she was playing the violin there. So I ended up in a, from the breathing fire, I ended up in a coma for 5 days, and I couldn't walk for 6 weeks.
Jesus Christ.
And, there was a...
What was this blowback from fire breathing?
Yeah, I was beefing by the tower, and they asked me to fire breathe because these clients were coming in. I was a jester. It was a nighttime gig. It's a medieval banquet. And I said, I've never done this before. He went, oh, please, I've told them to be a fire breather. Never done it before. So I did it, and it was the middle of winter, and the wind came back, and... set me face on fire.
God.
And it set me face on fire because I had the fuel in me mouth,
yeah,
which was lighter fuel, which you shouldn't have done.
Oh, God.
I had to breathe. And I breathed and it set fire down inside my lungs like this. So they stopped the show and I took a bow, apparently. And they took me downstairs to the toilets and started pouring water over my face. And they took me to hospital. And as I was in the hospital... I just remember standing there in a jester's outfit.
Oh God!
I just remember the paramedic I was with hit this red button. The next thing I woke up, I woke up 5 days later, and they brought me round, and I'd lost 25% of my lung capacity, and my lung, I would cough up lung for the following weeks. And I stayed in hospital, and the beautiful thing about that is when I was in hospital and when I couldn't work for 6 weeks, the street performers of Covent Garden We've got this tradition. If somebody's not well, they do a show for you. And you get the biggest earner or lots of them. And Richie, Lucky Rich, as he was known, did a show and came and give me money. They came in and they threw the money on the bed in the hospital when I was barely conscious. The nurses didn't know what to do with, you know, these crazy people that walked in. It was like the clowns had just come and they chucked all this money and brought me loads of food and stuff. And then for 6 weeks, they paid my rent. So
the day.
And why I was telling you all about that is because that's where I met Joy. And
yes.
Joy was also a costume maker. And I thought, can you make me a green spotted pantomime horse? And she made me a pantomime horse. And then a month later, she was pregnant. And we've now got three kids. And we've been together for 22 years.
The span, the course of your career, for me, the things that I think of as like the most standout elements of it are the pantomime horse shows, because you used to be one of the street performers who, I don't mean used to be, you still are, but I remember during that kind of halcyon period of my 20s doing the Edinburgh Festival. My 20s, as far as I remember, that it's just the Edinburgh Festival over and over again.
Yeah.
And you were the performer. You were one of two or three performers that all the other performers would go and see. You're one of those people you could watch your street show again and again and again and again. Partly because you were spectacularly inept. You know, people would take bets on your ability. But, you know, predominantly because it was always different, it was always kind, it was always engaging, it was always, I don't mean kind, it was sort of sentimental, but there was genuine risk and there were those things that make us feel magic. It wasn't someone doing a skills-based routine that happened to be outdoors. It was you working an audience and we'd sit there and watch you work an audience in like, it was like the 5 p.m. slot, yeah. The sundown slot, yeah. on the Royal Mile.
Yeah.
The things that I think of in your kind of performing background as I know it are that, Cherub's Garden, which we might talk about, the Dinosaur Circus, yeah. Which we might talk about, which you did first and is now someone else's version of it, is touring the world and yeah. Doing really well, and your musical career.
Yeah.
To my son, you are a sort of... A living cartoon character who's also his friend. Like, he's kind of word perfect on a lot of your silly songs. You do sleepy songs and not so sleepy songs, which you can get, which people can... The happy song, of course.
Sleepy songs
can,
and not very sleepy songs.
And not very sleepy songs, which we can listen to on Spotify. And you have been responsible for such a sort of a wide variety of really warm-hearted, generous, funny, exciting... artistic projects which haven't made you rich and famous.
No, and I didn't set out to be rich and famous. I wanted to do work. I started off in London in 1985. I came to London to be a hall porter in a hotel with my brother, and my brother went, one day, come round and see this. And we walked into Covent Garden and Captain Keno was doing a show in front of it. Must have been 700 people. And I went, my God, I want to do that. And then I realised I couldn't do that because I had nothing to offer. But what I had was, with me, I had a guitar. So I went in the underground and started playing. And I started playing three-chord songs and I would make money. I worked as a hall porter 2 days on, 2 days off. And the 2 days off, I'd go. And I lived in Northumberland Avenue, just off Trafalgar Square, because I lived in the hotel. And I did that. And I didn't know you could write songs. I didn't know, this is me at 16, 17, I didn't know that you could make a living as a performer. I didn't know that you could, I mean, I could write a play. I didn't know that I could record some music, and I didn't know that I could write a joke or create a piece of comedy. I didn't know that. I thought other people did that. And then suddenly... I'm like, right, I'm going to try and do this. So over the years, I've tried to do it. I played music. The Happy Song is a song. We had it on free download and it's, you know, tens of thousands downloaded. And I'm proud of it. Now, 20 years later, I recorded it with Robert Lee, who's a great friend, brilliant composer and producer and musician. And engineer, and I went to him and said, like I do with everybody, I go, I've got these songs, I want to record them. And he went, okay. So we went to a scout hut and we recorded these songs, and one of them is the happy song. And the happy song is my creed. I was brought up as a Catholic. And in the Catholic Church, there's a thing called the creed. And the creed is, I believe in one Lord Jesus Christ, his only son, and all that bollocks. And I'd thrown all that out later on. No disrespect to anybody that's Catholic. Good luck to you. And so I wrote my own creed. And it was, don't let your flittering belly of laughter take off and run away. And don't forget to smile just before you get out of bed each day. Don't let dancing be not very much fun. Don't be sad in the morning when you can't see the sun, etc., etc. I photocopied it. And when I was in Australia doing street shows, at the end of the show, because I didn't have a finale, I would say it and hand it out. If you come up and take some money, take my creed. So people would take it. I was in Covent Garden doing, just finished a street show, and it was a week after recording the album, and I had it on mini disc, a copy of it on mini disc, and one of the guys, Shandy South, had a mini disc, so I knew I could get to him and get him to do some copies for me, that's why I was in Covent Garden with it. And Shandy was listening to it, and I finished doing the show, and a guy came up to me and he said, I want to give you this piece of paper. And he gave me a photocopied piece of paper of what became the happy song of Don't Let Your Fritten. And he said, this is, look, I got given this, and I've been giving it to people after a street show. And I said, that's mine. And he went, no, it's not. You're bullshitting. I went, it's not. And then suddenly I went over to Shandy. I think John H., a good friend of ours that died. John H. was there listening to it, I think. And then the guy goes over. I bring him over. I go, it is. And then he listens to it. And it's just like, it's coincidence. It's not this great mythical thing that's happened. It's just a bit of probability coming together. And, you know, to do stuff like that. So that's my win. That's my win better than most other things. It's better than the best gigs I've ever done or the worst gigs I've ever done. That's my win.
If you were to try and sum up what is magical to you about street performing, for people who, I mean, I would imagine that the listener of this show is only hazily aware of street performing, probably only hears it mentioned when I very occasionally mention it on the show. obviously it means an enormous amount to me. It means a huge amount to you. So if you had to convince the casual listener who is still with us at this point of what it means to you, what would you say?
It's about the space. It's about making a space into a theatre. It's about the warmth of people that stand beside each other, that don't know each other and still at the end of the show won't, but are there. It's the same as an indoor show, but there's more aspects to play with. When you stand there on a pitch and you're ready to start a show and it's desolate or there's people milling around, you go... And I still go, this is never going to work. And then you work it until you find something that clicks and then suddenly they're with you. Physically, I mean, and emotionally. And you get that collectiveness. I'll tell you the thing about it. You can play delicate, really big. You can play the tiniest thing, really big. You can get the temperament of 500 people to sit with you and go on this little tiny stupid journey for a little bit of time. And you can be responsible for your own thing. I don't need an agent. I don't need a fee. I don't need an expectation. That's all of them things as a performer. But it stops people. It stops people. And then you're engaged with it and you're part of it and your world has just become small and contained. And then at the end of it, I love the disbursement of how people walk away, and I've done loads of analysis. I love analysis because I analyse football. I break a game down to 5,400 seconds and collect data four times a second. So I've been doing analysis of over the last few years of watching how people walk away. And they walk away with a different temperament, a different beat, a different physically pattern. And that's what's brilliant. So it's a stopper moment. It's a bit like Christmas Day. You know when Christmas Day, when there's no buses, when there's no trains, when everybody, there's no cars flying up and down, and the world just stops and just breathes for a bit. I know it sounds hippy trippy that, but a street show, when it works, when you get your time, does that. Whether it's on the West Piazza in Covent Garden, or if it's up in Edinburgh on the High Street, or if it's in, you know, I was in Ethiopia and they said, come, Mr. Herbie, come and do a show. Where? The arena. And I go, and it's a field with a big bank, and there's about 3,500 people. And you go, I'm, what am I going to do? And I start doing the show, and there's a trick that you can make a little red hanky appear and disappear from your hands. And I had that in my pocket. And I've had that maybe for 20 years as a backup, and I've never used it. I never used it. And I take this red, the hanky, I'm going, I need to do something. None of the other stuff, self-doubt. And I show it, and I put it into my fist, and I do that. And they all gasped. I nearly fell over. I was more taken than they. And then I took it back out, and then put it in my pocket. And that's not about me, because that's actually, somebody invented that mechanism, somebody, seen as almost like a standard. But that embodies street theatre. And it's harder to become a street performer anymore, because you actually can become a street performer, but so many physical spaces are controlled by private companies now that around the world, there's so much restrictions. I was part of, in 1985, I did shows till 4 o'clock in the morning in Leicester Square, and I'd be there. And there was a guy called Old Redbeard, we called him. He was the sergeant, and he'd walk through, and some days he'd like you, and some days he wouldn't like you. And he'd bring the van in, you'd get chucked in the van, they'd drive you around Soho. They used to have speed bumps in the back of Soho, for 45 minutes. Put you out and go, if you ever fucking come here again, we're going to slap the fuck out of you. And then you go back down to Leicester Square, because it was illegal then. And it was legal in Covent Garden because that was a licensed area. But I was scared to go in there because I couldn't do what they did. I couldn't do that. So I didn't go there and perform there for 10 years. Yeah, 1994, 9 years.
Talk to me about those 10 years of you coming down with your brother, seeing the shows and thinking, I want to do that. What was the gap between that and your first actual... So you did the guitar busking.
I did guitar busking, and then I finished the busking, and then somebody stole my guitar. So I thought, oh, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to buy a saxophone. So I went and bought a Corton saxophone for 195 quid that out of the busking. And I went in the underground, and I learned Saving All My Love For You, Summertime, and I can't remember the other one. There was another tune, I can't remember it. That's the only things I learned. So I played that for a bit, and then I ended up having nowhere to live and being on the N18 bus, which used to go down to Catford in a big circle, every night with these other guys, and we used to sit on that. And then I got that stolen because I got in a fight, and that was nicked. And that's when I started at that point. So that's about maybe 1985, in the June of 85, I'd watched performers doing, I wanted to be a magician, that's all. And I went to Leicester Square, and I was too scared to be around the other performers that were doing Leicester Square. So I'd wait till about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'd work from 2 till about 4. Now looking back, at we're the hardest people you could ever do shows in front of. And I would try and do the thing I would do. So I used to try and do the cup and ball, which I was no good at, and everybody, because they'd always see where the balls were and where I was holding them and the likes of. But the thing is, what I learned was that I could get a laugh. I could find a laugh and get a laugh. And I didn't care if it was at me or with me. Mm-hmm. I didn't give a shit about that. I went, oh, I can do this. And if somebody was mouthy with me, I could be mouthy back. But on a Sunday, every Sunday, I went to the place that taught me how to be a performer more than any other place. I went to Speaker's Corner, and I became a speaker there for quite a while.
What did you speak about at Speaker's Corner?
My opening gambit was, all the stupid people come over here. If you're stupid, come over here. If there's something you don't want to listen to, come over here. If you don't, you know, and I'd go off on one like that. And that was just like, I'd go. And that was freedom. And that took me about 2 years, 3 years to be. So I'd wait till the end of the night when there was a crate there and you'd get up on a crate and try to do it. And then I worked through on that and I enjoyed doing that. So every Sunday, most Sundays, I'd go down there and I'd stand there. And then I'd talk about being kind. I'd talk about, you know, if you're not stupid to people. The people who didn't come over stupid, you know, reverse. Mm-hmm. And that's where I learned about how to reverse language and how to play people and then play the idea and then turn the idea. I learned how to, I watched other performers and I learned how to deal with hecklers and to heckle, mm-hmm. which was really good fun because the hecklers there, they were all the same line every week. I knew I had to have something to come back. I learned how to include all them things, but I was very animated. And that's where, I think out of there, the clowning came. I even did one by just shouting, just going, right, I did that for a while. And that was quite interesting because that got a lot of attention and they couldn't touch me. So that play at Speaker's Corner and then I went off travelling. Me and my brother Mick went down to Nice in France. And I did a show there. That was like, I think the first time I did a near to a circle show that worked. And then I went to America and I did some stuff in America. And that's where I started to get an edge, which the edge is the front where you found that people were with you and watching the structure and learning. And then I went around Europe and started to work it. And that's the start of, that's maybe 87, 88, and I started to work. The festival circuit was just building up. And then I came back, and then I wanted to put a show on. So I wrote a show and took it to Edinburgh. And I didn't know Edinburgh existed. And that was 91. I took the show to Edinburgh, an indoor show. I grew up 103 miles from Edinburgh. I didn't know the biggest arts festival in the world was 103 miles up the road. Nobody ever told me that, and I couldn't believe it. And I did the show, and we did really well with the show.
What was the show?
It was called Stickled. It was a revolutionary toy shop tale by people and puppets, and it was about basically a toy shop where a ball arrives, and there's the toys with the batteries were the controllers, and the toys with the wind-ups. They took the mechanism out of the toy and put batteries in, and then the ball arrives and it was the sacred toy. And if they hit it, it moved and they didn't know how. So we did that. And then I went, oh, God, Edinburgh's incredible. So I was doing street shows in the jungle, which was a part of the mound where anything went. So I did that. And then I went off to Australia, did Australia, came back to London, went into Covent Garden, started working, and then I'd written my songs more and I'd written a show called Cherub's Garden, which I took to Nickelodeon when Nickelodeon first opened and Paramount Comedy Channel opened. I was there that night. I was next door and they gave me a chance and I didn't know the language. I didn't know what to do and I blew it and took that show to Edinburgh and then ended up with a transfer to the National Theatre.
So you blew it in terms of the TV thing.
Yeah.
And they like you didn't know how to have a meeting.
I didn't know. I couldn't, you know, I turned up.
Were you wearing shoes?
No, I wasn't. Seriously, I wasn't. You know, it's just like I turned up with a load of puppets and some ideas and some scripts. I'd written 60 scripts. They said, "Have you got a script?" I went, "Yeah," and I'd give them 60. I'd written, handwritten.
60 copies?
No, 60 episodes. 60 episodes.
Episodes, gotcha.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I wrote them over about 3 months. I just sat all day, writing, 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 all night. So I wrote them. you know. And, you know, stupid episodes like, you know, they have a, this isn't 1991, they have a, some cherubs and some angels live in the bottom of a garden, and they have a, two of them are having a discussion whether the world was flat or round. Because, you know, one of them said, if it's flat, how can you, it's got to be flat, it's on this piece of paper, because they had a map. So they're going to build a rocket to go up out of a vacuum cleaner and a giant balloon to go, and two chairs to go up to take a picture and come back. You know, it's absolute silly bollocks. Just any silly bollock idea I wrote.
Okay.
First thought process. Write the idea. Don't edit it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took it to Edinburgh and we did a show in Edinburgh. And it was really, it was a kid show. And it was really fun to do. And it was hard work. And then a bloke called Jonathan Holloway came to watch us, who now runs the Melbourne International Festival.
Until very recently.
Yeah, he's just left. Yeah. And
Jonathan Holloway, available for keynote speeches about all sorts.
Or
he's just a speaker, I think.
Or production work.
Yeah.
and we went and did it at the National Theatre. I mean, it was, you know, it was a small venue, but I'd like got to the National Theatre, which was funny, but, and it was great fun. And so on my CV, it looks great, but it's still not as good as doing a show on the High Street in Edinburgh during the festival and you've only got half an hour left and the sun's going down and you don't open your case. You're just standing there and you're going, right, and you don't speak and the audience are there. The audience are there that want to be there.
And the significance of not opening your case is that's what, when you open your case, that's got the gear in it. That those are the props that as soon as you open it, you know what the rest of the show is.
Yeah.
And the longer you don't open it for, the more you're just playing and living in the moment.
Playing in the time and playing with the physicality and playing with the people and being and stopping. And, you know, I love, because I don't work, well, I have worked with mics on the street especially, but I work with a lapel. Because the thing is, if you go out there and you get it in the middle of the noisiest street and you get it because people are tuned and they can hear the silence in the middle of that street, that's what you're looking for. You're not looking for the clap. You're not looking for the laugh. You're looking for the silence. If they can hear the silence, that means your temperament's gone down and you're ready. That means when the next laugh comes, it's gonna be big because you've taken them to the top and then back down at the bottom. And it's the temperament of the language, of the physicality of the people, not the performer, the collective thing, which is the same in comedy clubs or in variety theatres or whatever.
And are you entirely self-taught? Did you ever train anywhere or kind of were taken under the wing of other performers or anything like that? Or is it all about you watching and observing and trying and working? Like, you use the word work all the time. You work it and you work it, and I just worked it and I did. Do you know what I mean? It feels like a really, like a sort of lifelong DIY project to learn what this thing is that excited you and where your place was.
Street performers are really good at being supportive and critical in the street. So you go out and do something, and especially the collective friends that I've got, that you're part of, a generation that we came up together, you talk about, they'll talk to you directly about the craft. They'll talk to you. If you came off, they don't say that was shit. You'll go, that didn't go too well, did it? And then you'll talk it through, but you've got another chance straight away. So I learned by watching. I'm still a fan. Like, I'm a fan of your podcast and your Facebook, the ComCom Facebook mm-hmm. group, is because I get the questions that people ask. And I get, because I still ask the questions, I still stand at the back. If I walk down to Covent Garden today and I don't do street shows there anymore, I'll still stand and watch a show. I'll stand and watch it from the back. I'll watch the people. That's the interest. Two things that I did get taught. Improbable Theatre, I think they're called. There was mm-hmm. a guy called Marcello. It was one
Magni,
of the,
Marcello Magni.
I don't.
Yeah, I think so.
I've met him once.
Yeah.
somebody, Fraser Hooper, who's another fantastic mm-hmm. clown, I think it was Fraser, said, come and see this guy. And I just remember being up in this to go and do a workshop. I'm like, fucking workshop, Jesus Christ. Why don't you just go and do it on the street? You know, that kind of thing. And this was me in my 20s.
Yeah.
And then I go, I remember being in this top of a building in a, like a dance studio with the roof really close. And this guy comes out and he starts talking. There's maybe 30 people in there. And he shows a mask called a neutral state mask, which is a, what's his face? The other, that French clowny.
Lecoq.
Lecoq, who actually the mask is from Coppo, who was a contemporary of his.
Okay.
And it's a neutral state mask. And he puts this mask on. And he talks about the status of your body and about relaxing to that kind of zero point. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, this is bollocks. Get on with it, get on with it. And then I put the mask on. I'm like, whoa. And I'm like, oh, this feels weird. Then I take the mask off and because I've done it, I watch them and I get it. The idea of that physical, because what he ended up saying was not about go to the, because a lot of, especially clowning people think, go to the neutral and build from the neutral. And that wasn't the point. The point was know what the neutral is, but know what you are outside the neutral and adjust from who you are into the physicality. It's not about kind of you becoming a hunch, you know, with your shoulders up and all that kind of, it's more of pace and temperament and time and how you can walk, man. And I got from that, I knew in a show, when I'm walking 10 feet and I stand and turn around, I just have to look, tiny little look. If something's happened behind me and I'm not aware of, and there's a laugh because something's happened behind me, say from an audience member, I just have to look like that. And when I look like that, I'll get another laugh on that, playing that thing. And also, I've got a dear friend called John Carlin, who's an actor, musician from New York. And I'd never read a book. And John's like, you'd never read a book. So I went.
You'd never read a book?
I'd never read a book. No. And so I was 20 and I went to Hammersmith Library to read a book in a day. He said, go and read a book in a day. And he goes, read Winnie the Pooh. So I read Winnie the Pooh from cover to cover. I finished it just 5 minutes before. And the woman upstairs, I think one of the hardest things I'd done. I physically read a book all the way. I sat down. It took about 7 hours. It just like, and then he said, the next book, he said, look at this book. And it was Improv, the book by
Keith Johnston.
And he opened it up and he said, look at this. And I never read the whole book. And it was the section on status and the statuses of you and I at the moment, this is your podcast, you're of the higher status, but it could be perceived that I am the guest, so I'm the highest.
Sure,
status.
Sure. And then, it's about how every interaction between every character, between every person, you are either raising or lowering yours or their status with everything you said.
So if I walk into a comedy club with you and everybody knows you, then you're of the higher status. And if you walk into an international festival where everybody knows me and nobody knows you, a street festival, then vice versa. And that changes. And that just was groundbreaking. That just grabbed me. I'm like, this is what this is all about. I'm playing this game. And that's the clowning thing. I found out about playing the low status. And when you get down to that low status, you become invincible. And then people talk to me about, you know, about King Lear and the Fool when he says, when he's chucked one of his daughters away or something like that. I don't even know the story. He banishes his daughter or something like that. And the fool says, take my coxcomb, which is the hat, take it. You're the fool. And he said, I'll whip thee. And then he goes, then what will you do? And it's just like the idea that the fool, the most powerful man, the fool becomes the power. And playing that in clowning and in street and in talking stuff, it becomes really enormous. Because if I'm low status, I can't go wrong. I got punched square in the face in the middle of a show in Covent Garden and floored by a guy that came. And I understood his point of view. He didn't know that the audience, there was a few hundred people behind him.
Yeah.
So he thought it was...
You thought you were just an individual winding him up.
Wind him up?
Yeah.
I went to the floor and I'm down on the floor and now I go, what am I going to do? Because my ratty little kind of northeast kind of, I'm ready, I'll get up and shall we have a scrap? Because I don't care. And I thought, I can't do that. And then I just pointed and I lay on the floor and I just pointed and he just followed my finger and he looked. Then he seen the audience. And that was a good thing, but that, you know, Keith Johnston taught me how to do that. And I've never even met him. I just like, I knew if I stayed there, he could have given me a kicking.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough. But by doing that, I knew if I just waited for a minute, for a second, a moment, and I did that, he looks out and then he gets it. Then he's embarrassed. And I just go, it's okay. It's okay. And I said, I'm sorry. And I get up and I get the gift because I give him a hug and he gives me a hug back.
Oh, my God.
And it was just like, and then off he goes. And I know you understand this because you've seen what can happen there. This, yeah. That's what street theatre is about. These things that happen, and I know they happen in comedy clubs and in theatres, especially with comedy, especially in comedy clubs. You know, I can't do comedy clubs because I tried.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. I did a lot of stuff in the late 80s, early 90s, and I tried. But, you know, I was just the headache. Because I turn up with stuff. And I, you know, I'd have to get, you know, and they'd go, can you do a five? I don't even think I knew what a five meant. It's just like, go on there and do that. All right, I'm going to do it. Oh, look, somebody over there. Let's build some chairs.
Yeah.
You stand up. And, you know, I'd finish. And that particular one was a cabaret club up in North London. I think the Etcetera Theatre or somewhere like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a cabaret. There was a load of comedians on and some off-the-wall stuff. And then, no, it wasn't in there. It was...
People Camden feel. Jonglers or something.
It was something like that.
When they did proper variety bills.
Yeah. And so I did one out in East London. I remember doing that. I think it was the opening night, and I tied a rope called Jesters.
Yeah.
I tied a rope between the pillars. I tried to do a slack rope routine in the middle of a comedy club. So it never worked. And they just like, they were glad to get me out. And I didn't know how to conduct myself in a kind of professional way, but, you know, as it is now. So that's why the street give me that freedom. And I'm like, all right, this is where I am.
You take genuine risks on the street, risks that in some cases result in you being punched in the face. You know, there's like, I always think that when comics talk about how, not that any comic walks around saying how edgy and risky they are, but they certainly, well, some of them probably do, but, you know, there is certainly a sort of an assumption that that comedy contains real rawness. And I do think of some of the rawness that I've seen on the street as a kind of counter-argument to, yeah, it's raw. How raw is he? Okay, someone might get up and punch you, conceivably, but it doesn't happen that often on a stand-up stage. Can we talk about nicking a bin lorry, or it'd be better not?
Wow.
We can delete that.
No, come on, let's talk about it.
You and let's not name your accomplices.
Should we name them? Shall I tell you the whole story?
Well, I don't know if we should name them because I think you have permission to talk about your part of the story. We can't get their consent necessarily.
All right. In Edinburgh, there's a square called Hunter Square. It's where the high street started, basically. And
the Tron. It's next to the Tron and the Monkey Barrel, if that's helps.
So I was doing a show. I had a show there and I didn't want to do the show by myself. So we decided that two of the performers, one of them a legend physical clown, and another one, a fantastic friend of ours who was just starting performing in his early stages of performing. So we'd been out the night before and we start doing the show together, all three of us. And we'd never done a show together. And I'd done a show with each of them two individually. And with this other street clown, we'd worked together quite a lot. A bin wagon pulls up during the show.
Like a lorry, a bin lorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're changing the thing. And there's always an interaction with the bin with the bin crews, and they're really good fun.
Because one of the unique aspects of that pitch is that there is a road right behind it. Road so right there beside. Would often be interaction with vehicles.
So for a laugh, we get into the bin wagon, which you would do. And they're standing there. And I'm in the driving seat. And I rev it, close the door.
Like the driver's not in it. Where is the driver at this stage?
They're changing the bin.
Okay.
They've got out to change the bin.
Okay.
I'm there then. I pull the door shut. And the other two said, well, are we going to do it? And that's enough of a... That's the risk factor. There's 200, 300 people watching. It's like, we've committed, so we better do it. So I drive the bin wagon off down the road, but it's a one-way street. So I drive down to the bottom of the hill and realise I can't reverse back up. By the way, I don't have a driving licence.
Oh, God.
So we have to drive it down to the bottom of the street.
But, my Lord, I was being a clown. I had committed.
Yeah. We drove left, and then you've got to go all the way down to almost the bottom of the Royal Mile, turn back around and come back up, wait at the traffic lights, turn left and come back in. It's 10 minutes. There's three clowns in a bin wagon. I'm just thinking, if the police see three clowns in a bin wagon, I mean, we just look like homeless clowns.
Yeah.
And then we put it back in. And unfortunately, the woman who was driving it was her first day at work. So our fun and games, we get out and they're like, and I know one of the other bin men really well.
Mm.
He's like, Herbie, we're ready to call the police. You can't do this. And I'm like, I'm sorry. We did it for a gag.
Were the audience still there?
Yeah. Triple.
Yeah.
Triple. It's just like they knew. And then, my God. And then the woman's like, I'll get sacked now. I'm like, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. I'm really, what can I do? She's like, don't ever do that again. I'm like, so that risk and that danger and like the commit, because I think in the street we don't see it as risk and danger. Mm. I think it's about commit. It's like you've got the freedom to commit to something and you've got to see how far you can take it because you're responsible for yourself. Can you take it to the, at which point are you going to get off? Because the train will go on. It will go on and on and on, you know, and that's the risk.
And how did that show end? Were you having that conversation with the lorry drivers?
Yeah, they went off and we went, and then I think we finished it up, but we didn't have it, which is the collect. You go, okay, so that's the game. I wouldn't get to that point now, though, in life.
Yeah.
I say that. That's not true. I'd do it differently. I couldn't work that pitch for 10 years after that, physically, for myself. I couldn't go there, and I couldn't work on that pitch. I worked there about 3 years ago.
Did you find out if that lady did lose her job?
No, I seen her years later.
And she didn't?
No, she didn't. She did. But everybody just backed off and left her. You know,
yeah.
Don't mess with her. Because I screwed up a really nice little interactive that collectively belonged to the community. From then on, you couldn't do it. You couldn't play with them.
Yes, yes. To borrow a line from therapy, what would you have done? What would you do differently this time? Like what other kind of perform? Presumably there were lots of other performative options, or were there no other options once you'd all bundled into the cab?
I would have played clown car. I've thought about this. So what you do is I get in and then the other person gets out and runs around and goes, no, I want to get in. So they jump out and then the other person goes around. So there's a game there that's nice, that's interactive. And then I would have most likely climbed on top of it and stood on top of it, which would have been really good fun. And that would have been 15, 20 foot high, me on top of a bin wagon. Who knows? I would have tried to, I could have maybe done the really dangerous thing of climbed into the back of the mechanism that moves. So.
Yeah, maybe not that one.
I know, but it's, that's the thing about it. It's like, yeah, the risk is that they're not going to press the button. I wouldn't do it when they were near the button. I'd do it, but that's the thing. So.
And what is it about?
No, but the answer to your question is, I would have just left them alone.
Yeah.
I would have left them alone. I would have played with them with some rubbish or something tiny and just got on with my life.
So what is it about your personality that means you would cast physical safety to the wind in order to pursue the risk for the sake of the joke? Is it the risk about it being funny? Is it the risk is to do with it being mythic, to do with it just being what you have to do? Or is it to do with a self-destructive streak in you, or a streak in you which makes the game of the show more important than your freedom or physical safety?
I don't think about the physical safety. I think it's the freedom to do. I built in Edinburgh a few years ago, I built a contraption which was a big, massive seesaw that was about 15 foot high. And I put a member of the audience, and it was all done with wagon straps and stuff like that. And I built it. And I put a member of the audience on the other side in a plastic chair. Then, and it was a big ladder that went out, and I had to climb out to the other side and create a counterbalance. The idea was I was going to then juggle, stand on it and juggle. But back, I still can't juggle. But I found that it wouldn't balance right. So then I used to get women to put their handbags on the end, which they were really reluctant, because I learned after that women treasure their handbags. And I didn't know that. So they'd hang them on the end, and this guy who's from the audience would be sitting there, just levitating about 4 or 5 feet. And I remember one day going, if I fall off backwards now, I've got no helmet on, I'll most likely die. That's one of the few times in my life in performance going, fucking hell, I've got to be careful here. I'm getting a bit older. You know, if I slip backwards, because I recognised, I've run a circus and I've run tents and venues, so I know about risk assessment now. So that comes into it going, if I fall off backwards, how do I risk assess this to fall off backwards? So I worked out, if I've got a piece of rope that's tied to the thing and I tie it to my belt, that means I can't fall backwards. But it means if he gets off, I'm fucked. But, you know, that's where life started to change a bit. But I'll take the risk. I'll take the risk not to go, ooh, I want to be edgy. I'm not. That's not the intention. I want to take the risk because I want to see what the parameters of the adventure brings and what the audience reaction, and see if they'll go there with, you know, if they'll go with us. Because we as performers, even any kind of performance, we're good at creating this perceived myth of something. So, you know, if you're juggling knives, you dress, even if you tell people the knives are not sharp, by the time you've got to that point of reselling it back to the people don't care because they've bought into it. This is back to the Santa thing. You know, I'm there as Santa. Even if people walk in and kids walk in and think I'm not Santa, by the time my job is within 3 minutes is to go, oh, I've just met Santa. And all of that myth and that connection with the world is, that's where the risk comes from. And funny enough, Santa's become more of a risk than doing silly shit in the street. And the payoff can be great.
Because it's more of a risk because there is more at stake with the individual and the state of the child or the person that is having the Santa encounter.
Yeah.
Like, it means something to them. So that meaning, the weight of that is the risk.
Yeah. And you've got to pull it off. And you can't let it go halfway through. You've got to keep a hold of it. And especially in the street. It's so demographic. The democracy of it is that anybody's there. And the minute you commit to it, they're with you. So that it's interesting, the risk it's about. The kind of... I'll only do the risk if the people are there and I feel that they'll allow me to take. I think quite in your trade, in stand-up, it's quite interesting. I see a lot of comedians that are trying to look for the risk. And what happens is when you look for something, you try too hard. In the street, you don't have to go looking for it because it's there if you want it. If you, I hope you understand that. It's like, and I think that's the difference between, because I nearly became a stand-up comedian. I don't think I would have survived. I don't think I would have done much with it because I think I've been able to do more with what I've done and you end up who you are anyway. But I'm gabbling a bit. So I think that I'm trying to say something that I haven't quite formed.
That was me leaving a pause in case I can inspire you to get to the bottom of that thing. What is it?
It's the... the thing I'm saying about what I recognise, especially in today, it's not like it used to be, because he's 51. Because he's changed more than the world has changed. But yeah, the world's changed at the same time. Is I see... because stand-up comedy is everywhere.
Yeah.
Street performance everywhere. And street performance still secret. It's still something that you can either ignore or you can get. And I've talked a lot about, we've talked a lot about risk. And there's nothing worse than performers talking about being risky. And I think the point I'm trying to get to was that, like I said, in a lot of stand-up, I see the mechanisms of people trying to be risky. I will talk this. Why I've got a bit more of an understanding. I became I took a year out as well, part-time, and I became a technician at a theatre. And I've seen 100 stand-up comedy acts come through within a year. I've teched everybody. I've teched some of the biggest names in TV down to people I've never met before. And... It's great being a technician because you can watch. Because you're playing with formulas all the time to be a technician, you watch even more the formula of the performer, not just stand-up comedians, but theatre and comedy and music. And the thing is, everybody's looking for risk. And especially indoors, everybody's looking for risk. But outside, the freedom is there for the risk. You don't have to chase it to be dangerous in what you say. You don't have to be... It's there. And you can...
it's inherent.
It's inherent. And what you can do is you can jump on it and ride it. And if you do that, and I'm not saying that it's successful because it's not. You know, you're only as good as your next show. So it's not successful because it's still I might do that. I might get that twice in 10. But there's more freedom to be able to discover that risk, not to try and contrive it. I still contrive it. And some of my mates still contrive it. And sometimes it's awful and sometimes it's brilliant.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Before we wrap up,
What are your flaws as a performer? What's held you back as a performer?
My lack of discipline. Too many ideas. If I have an idea, I'll do the idea at the minute in the room I'm staying in. I'm building a 7-foot life-size baby, even though baby's not 7-foot life-size. A puppet that cries and that farts, and I'm building it, and the woman thinks I'm a bit mental. So it's not going down well. So the flaws are unhappiness came and hit me for a long, long time. And I'm overcoming that now, and I know how to deal with that. I wasn't educated enough to know how to play the game and the business. But at the moment, I think I'm glad. Being a technician was quite interesting, watching people that have hit big time. I've teched people that have been and done 10,000 seaters and were in my little theatre. And it's really interesting watching them going, you're the same age as me and you've just been on a different journey, but we're in the same physical place at this moment. So my flaws are, too many ideas all the time. But I'm not going to give that up, because I believe in 100 and you get one. But in my case, if I have 100 ideas, I'll get 200. And, the inability to just to not fucking emails, to answer an email, not to send invoices. One year I had £7,500 worth of invoices over 2 years that I hadn't sent off. I don't want the money, even though I need it. I just, and that's not me being big going, oh, I've got £7,500 worth, It's just like, I got lucky inabilities to do all of that thing, which I'm slowly learning, which football statistics is teaching me how to do that. I've become interested in mathematics.
To finish off the part of the conversation that is about risk. When risk goes well, you succeed and you create a genuinely magical thing that is memorable and meaningful for you and for them. When you take a risk and don't pull it off, this is the reason people take fewer risks than some of us perhaps might, it feels terrible. It feels dog shit. It's a car crash. How do you cope with it when it goes wrong? How have you historically coped with things going badly?
It doesn't go wrong. You just get different elements of outcome. So when you start, this is me, when I start to try and do something, if I do it and then end up with an outcome, that's the outcome that it is. It mightn't be, I don't set something up and go, I would like it to end up being like this. I've never thought that way. I've thought, I'm going to do this thing and we'll see what happens. If I end up harming somebody emotionally or physically, then I have to address that. Then what I'll do is I'll stop that. And the learning point is that I'll change that and not do it again, hopefully, and then live that experience when 20 years later, in the middle of the night, going, I wish I hadn't done that, as we all do. But there's only outcome.
I think that's laudable and intellectual. How do you cope in the moment when it goes horrible and you walk off, sad?
I think I've worked mechanisms to not end up, I know my job now. I know my job is to make people hopefully happy, not even laugh, just happy, and to laugh possibly. And if I've got something out of it, if something happens, that's the thing about doing street shows, if that's happened in the street, you deal with the consequence because the people are there, there's no security there, there's nobody to throw them people out or to throw you out. You deal with that people if something happens, which as many times has happened with people in audience and the likes of, you deal with them. And you go up to them, and it's back to the status. You have to be humble. You have to come back to the humility. I'll say sorry. I won't say sorry much in life, not in relationships and that. I find, because I'm a stubborn bloke. But in, it's funny. It's like if I take the risk and it causes harm, any kind of harm. Ooh, I'll like that with that woman with the bin wagon. I'll just, you know, I'll live that, and I won't do that again. But the numbers are on my side. If I take a risk, just, you know, be more caring. I have to be more caring. But the older I get, the less I'm doing this, because it physically hurts now. But that's why I'm going to build a big, enormous puppet circus. But every puppet has to be able to go on the X51 bus, because you've got to pack it down. I'm not having any trailers or trucks or buses, which we used to have to tour with. If it doesn't go on the X51 bus, it doesn't come with me. I haven't answered your question again.
What happens if something goes wrong when you're being Santa?
It'll never go wrong. When you're Santa, it can't go wrong. Because because Santa is bigger than that. It's not me being a performer. It's not me being a clown. It's about me being Santa. And that means it can never go wrong.
That's extraordinary. I feel like I believe that without ever having done that gig myself, and maybe it'll be in my future one day. I have to say, part of it does appeal to me. Maybe not such a long shift, but I love to believe that. I won't know that firsthand, but like things, you know, kids, you see these awful photos of kids crying on Santa's lap and stuff like that. Have you had tearful kids and upset kids and stuff like that? And what's the rhythm of that? How do you cope with?
I tell the parents, because the parents are under stress straight away and are trying to push the kid onto me or near me for a thing. There's no sitting on knees anymore. And I have to then manage the parents usually and manage the kids. And I ask everybody to stop talking. And we do 10 seconds of stop talking. And then it just stops and it changes it. But if the kid's crying, I tell them to go for a walk and come back. We'll try again. And it's usually parents with the first kid. And the kids too. And they want the picture. They want to give the picture.
Yeah, sure, sure.
And I get, the big thing is, I get the parents to come in. I do the family picture, which is so much more important than having the kid by themselves. Because they're trying to put the kid on here and I'm trying to hold the kid and the kid's never met me.
Yeah. And you look weird. Because you're all dressed strange and it's all heightened. And
it's all heightened and all. And yeah, so that's the big thing of like, they come in. That's why it can never go wrong with Santa. Even that's not going wrong. They're going to have the picture in 25 years' time and then go, look, this is you. And Santa contorted, crying. And Santa's, you know. So that's it.
Thanks, Santa.
Merry Christmas.
So that was Santa. Thanks so much to Santa for coming along. Thank you so much to Herbie Treehead for bringing him. If you would like to follow Herbie Treehead, I'm not honestly sure where you can do that. You can certainly catch up with some of his stuff. He's got some little bits and bobs of promo on Facebook if you search Herbie Treehead, and you might find yourself falling down quite an enjoyable circusy rabbit hole if you do that. You can also listen to the Happy Song. You can listen. We only spoke about it a little bit, but Herbie Treehead's album, Sleepy Songs and Not So Sleepy Songs, is available on Spotify. And I urge you to listen to it, especially if you have young children. But I've got such happy memories of going along to see the Herbie Treehead Disaster Band at Glastonbury and festivals and street festivals all over the place, and seeing his genuinely unique brand of absolute silliness. So do check him out on Spotify, but really you've got to see him perform live somewhere. So if you are ever at a Spiegel tent somewhere in the world, or at the Winchester Hat Fair or the Edinburgh Festival or anywhere else, if you see his name chalked up on a board somewhere, Do not miss Herbie. Thank you so much to him for coming along. Thanks to all the usual suspects. Thank you so much, Nathan Wood, for looking after the show and producing it and editing it and uploading it and all of that terribly tiresome faff. He has been your Bob Cratchit today. Thanks also to J.K. Crossland, who is your... I'm going to quickly run out of of Scrooge characters. He's your Jacob Marley, perhaps. And Peter Dobbing, as always, is your Tiny Tim. I've been Stu Goldsmith. I'm not going to do any advertising blurb of anything on here, but I hope you all have a fantastic Christmas, and I hope that the country will heal itself. I'm recording this on the day of the election, but I've just flown to LA to do the aforementioned set on Conan, and as a result, I haven't been able to boast about it on social media because I've been too busy weeping and reading everyone else weeping on social media. I hope that whatever your political persuasion, you can find something to be hopeful about. Oh, God! Listen, this is a broad church, so to everyone, regardless of your politics, I hope you have a wonderful Christmas and a very happy new year. Loads of cracking content coming your way soon, including John Kearns, Ishan Akbar, we have Jamali Maddox, and someone else very exciting as well, who, Tom Basden. And I just had a real dream guest go in the diary for February next year, so plenty to enjoy there. Have a great time. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are...
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.